Matthew Boyd and Frankie Montas is signed while Tommy Edman gets extended. The stove is lukewarm. Yes, welcome on in to First Pitch for Tuesday, December 3rd, your source of news, notes, and updates on Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Lindsey Crosby. You can follow me on Twitter at Crosby Baseball. He's Troy Brock, Troy B Baseball on the Twitter machine. And Troy, I want to get to the golden at-bat proposal, right? I want to get to Tommy Edman's extension with the Los Angeles Dodgers. But there was a pair of free agent signings over the weekend. Frankie Montas goes to the New York Mets. Matthew Boyd to the Chicago Cubs. And let's look at both of these signings, both the details of these, and then maybe what these can tell us about the starting pitching market. And what this tells us about is, has Scott Boras maybe changed the way he's approaching the offseason? But Montas first. So the New York Mets have agreed to a two-year, $34 million deal with Montas, $17 million in both 25 and 26, and he has an opt-out after 2025. It's really, to me, it's really kind of a, at first glance, it's an odd deal, right? Because when you look at what he did, was acquired from Oakland, goes to New York, pitches a grand total of 41 innings across two seasons, just dealt with a lot of injuries. And then in 2024, ERA over five with Cincinnati, gets moved to Milwaukee, and things get better, right? His strikeout rate jumps to 11 per nine, but the ERA is still 4.55. If you're the Mets, why do you guarantee him, I guess not guarantee, but why do you offer him $34 million for two seasons when the results on paper weren't that good?
It does not make a lick of sense to me in the slightest, because it's just, and to be honest, you were right the first time. He is guaranteed $34 million, because with $17 million on the table, he's not going to make more than that from any other team. He's going to accept that option, and he's going to stick around for 2026. But he's just, he never lived up to the hype that was surrounding him early in his career. And that could be because of the plethora of injuries that he's dealt with over the years. And it just could be from just not being as good as he was expected to be, because he's got a 4.09 career ERA, and that's across 744 innings since 2015. He did not pitch at all in 2016. He debuted right in 2015. He's qualified for the ERA title once. He's made 30 or more starts in a season twice, which he did do that in 2024. He made 30 starts in 2024, but it's just, it's when you step back and you look at it and you look at what their roster consists of right now and what they were expected to do this offseason, their rotation right now is Kodai Senga and Frankie Montas and the boys. And it's, Kodai Senga is also a guy that has shown through two seasons in the majors that he really can't stay healthy. Frankie Montas cannot stay healthy. Their rotation is living on a wing and a prayer right now, and it's like they're banking on their offense to help them be successful in 2025, and they're most likely not going to re-sign Pete Alonso. We don't know what they're going to do in free agency as far as their offense goes yet. There still is a couple months, but as it stands right now, they have Francisco Lindor, who offensively is not consistent. He had a really good second half of 2024, but over his career, he has not been consistent. He has not been consistently great. He has been good. He has not been consistently great.
Great.
Defensively, he's fantastic, but other than that, they have Mark Vientos, who had a great postseason. Can he do it over a full regular season? We have yet to see him have a full regular season of that. They have Acuna's brother. I'm not going to try to pronounce his first name because I'm going to butcher it, but we have not seen him in a full season. He had a good debut late in the season, but it was a small sample size. Can he do that over the full season? And other than that, they really don't have anybody offensively unless they sign somebody through free agency. So as it stands right now, the Mets took a massive step back from where they were in 2024, and Frankie Montas does not move the needle in the slightest.
Okay. So you have thoughts. Yeah.
Just
yeah.
One or two.
Yeah. Looking at the offense real quick before I get back to Montas, I do think part of the issue that they're dealing with offensively is the steps back for Brandon Nimmo and Jeff McNeil. Both guys, you know, signed to extensions in their 30s. Last year, McNeil bats 238, Nimmo bats 224. And I don't think that's what they were expecting from those guys. They thought they were going to do a little bit more than that. And you combine that with Francisco Alvarez slumping a little bit. He batted 237 last year as the primary catcher. You end up in a situation where, you know, they were really carried, like you said, kind of by Francisco Lindor and Mark Vientos. And Lindor, to your point, you know, batted 197 in the first month of the year. It was respectable all around, right? 263 in May, 274 in June, but he didn't get, I mean, July. His June was 290, but he didn't start batting 300 until August and September. And obviously it was enough to propel them to the, you know, the postseason and all that. But it does feel like the strength of this team as of now is probably going to have to be the offense, because your rotation, David Peterson, Paul Blackburn, Tyler Megill, was kind of the end of that rotation. And I don't feel like they're going to be that satisfied with that as the back end of their rotation. Looking at Montas, though, I have two theories that I want to float to you on this. Theory number one is, given how early in free agency this was, is it possible that they see something in Frankie Montas, some way that they think they can fix him that nobody else, the Brewers, the Reds, you know, the Yankees, that nobody else was able to figure out? Is it possible that that is the angle here, is that they saw something in the profile, whether it was his arm slot dropping in his performance when he went to Milwaukee, something like that, because his velocity went up, his strikeout rate went up? Is it possible that they see something in him that they think they can unlock, and that's why they were so early to go out and get him?
That could very well be the case. I mean, they were able to kind of fix Sean Manaea to make him a little bit more respectable of a pitcher.
Oh, he was great last year. I thought that was I don't think anybody thought he was going to do what he did.
Yeah, he was much better last year than anyone expected, for sure. And the Mets could be a big part of that. And maybe they could do the same thing with Frankie Montas. And maybe we can add them into that same group of teams we talked about last week, the Astros, the Braves, and the Rays. But we got to wait and see on that.
Yeah. The other thing here is it, I mean, if you think about $17 million a year, he did make 30 starts last year. Is it just possible that the going rate to get 30 starts now is somewhere between $15 and $17 million? Like, is that just, we have to stop thinking that $12 million is the price of admission for a starter, and we just need to understand now that starting pitching, veteran starting pitching, that you can pencil in for 30 starts? Because again, prior to the injuries, you know, with Oakland and New York, 32 starts in 21, 27 starts in 22, despite the trade. And that's when he got hurt, I think, for the first time. And then 30 last year. Is it just $15 to $17 million is the price of admission now for a veteran that will post and give you 150 innings?
Yeah, that could also be the case. I mean, you are making very, very good points here, Lindsay. But it's that could definitely be the case too. It might be, and I mean, we've seen it across baseball. The price of admission is going up across baseball. Like you talked about, the price for one WAR is a lot closer to 9.x million than it was a couple of years ago when it was 5 to 6 million. So that could most definitely also be the case.
Yeah. The other theory, and I've seen a couple people throw this out a little bit. I don't quite know how much I buy this, but we look at how many Scott Boras clients have already signed, which is really feels like it's uncharacteristic, because normally his clients are waiting as long as possible to maximize the financial return. Do we think that is Boras learning the lessons of the struggles of his big free agents last year, where, you know, Snell started off really slow and didn't have a spring training. He recovered, obviously. Jordan Montgomery started off slow and never recovered. Or do we think Boris has so many high-profile free agents this year, including the generational talent in this class and Juan Soto, that teams are jumping in and being aggressive at offering his clients money to make sure they stay on his good side to have a better shot at trying to sign a Corbin Burns, a Juan Soto, a Pete Alonso? Do we think that that may have something to do with it? Or is he, do you think he's not necessarily forcing these teams to be aggressive with his guys as leverage?
Yeah, I think he just learned his lesson from last year with the struggles that they had getting signed last year. I mean, if you look at it, even Matt Chapman signed an extension in the season. When was the last time we saw a Scott Boras client sign an extension in the middle of a season? I'd have to look it up, but I can't think of one off the top of my head. And I think he learned his lesson with last offseason.
Yeah, it feels like for hitters, they're fine. Because like we hear so many veterans talking spring training. They're like, spring training's too long. Give me 2 weeks. 2 weeks of live pitching and they're good to go. Pitchers, obviously, they need the 6 weeks, the 8 weeks, whatever it is, of throwing and stretching out and everything to get into form to be ready for the season. I think I'm going to argue it's a little bit of both. I do think that you do probably see a little bit of teams being aggressive with going after Boris clients because they're already in conversations with Boris about other guys. But I do think part of it too is he's probably learned a little bit of a lesson. And so he's trying to make sure that the guys whose signings are not waiting on Juan Soto, that you can go ahead and get them placed. And then as soon as Soto is placed somewhere, then you'll start seeing the other big names that are, you know, teams are waiting to see if they can repurpose that Soto money to go get a Corbin Burns, to go get a Pete Alonso and guys like that. It is. I do think that we are seeing a little bit of the inflation of pitching salaries as well, simply because it's just so hard to find reliable pitching now. And I do think that there's a lot of things we're going to have to look at changing. Like, for instance, the list of qualified, what it takes to be a qualified pitcher in baseball now. Like 162 innings across a season feels like it's probably not a great idea to leave that as the standard, as much as fans want it to be, simply because it's so rare for a dude to actually throw that many innings. I'm in Baseball Reference right now, and guess how many pitchers actually would qualify for the ERA title this season or for any of the leaderboards by pitching one inning per team game.
Both leagues combined?
Both leagues combined.
24.
It's actually more than that. It's 58, okay. Believe it or not. But a decade ago, it was double that. It was over 100, right? And it's, you know, so like the average team now is lucky to have two guys that qualify for an ERA, like to qualify for leaderboards. And so it feels like the price of admission now for starting pitching is, you know, for a guy who's going to make 30 starts, and they may not even, the guy who makes 30 starts may not even qualify for some of these things, which is what's wild to me. But it feels like that is now, that is just kind of now the price of admission. Like that's what you just have to pay. There's guys, some of these guys barely qualified for, you know, despite making 30 starts, which is what's absolutely wild to me.
Yeah.
Zach Little, Marcus Stroman made 29 starts and threw 154 and 2/3 innings. Like he was around the full season. Luis Gil, 29 starts, 151 innings. Like he's rookie of the year. He didn't qualify for league leaderboards because he didn't pitch 162 innings. And so I feel like some of it's that. Just your requirements for filling out your rotation have dramatically inflated. On that same note, Matthew Boyd, 2 years, $29 million, with the Cubs. another $1 million in performance bonuses, so he's guaranteed $30 million over 2 years. Another Boris Klein as well. Turns 34 in the spring. I think it's early February. And last year didn't debut until August because he was coming back from injury. But 8 starts for the Guardians, 2-2, 2.72 ERA, and 39 2/3 innings. Struck out 46 against 13 walks. And then when he gets to the postseason, he makes 3 starts. So 11 2/3 innings, 1 run, 14 strikeouts. 2 things can be true at once, right? Like, we can like that Matthew Boyd got paid, but we can also think that the Cubs absolutely should be shooting higher than Matthew Boyd in their rotation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we did talk about that they really don't need to make a massive addition to their rotation, but I don't think we were thinking of going this small as the addition on their rotation. Because, yeah, it's I'm looking at his underlying numbers here. I mean, BABIP is kind of right there, close to in line with his career average. His home run rate is way down. His strikeout rate is way up, and his walk rate is right there.
Yeah.
And it's just, I feel like there's just going to be massive regression back to what he is normally putting up, because, I mean, that's a small sample size. 39 2/3 innings for a starting pitcher, that's a small sample size.
And coming back from Tommy John, and he's a guy who's been injured a lot, right? Like, he had a torn flexor tendon in 2021. You know, he came back for the Tigers in 23, 15 starts, wasn't great, had Tommy John. And so it just feels like this is, in essence, $15 million a year for a guy that you're going to have workload concerns with next year. And the likelihood here is that you're going to end up having to move him to the bullpen at some point in time in the season because of that workload. When you combine the minors and the majors last year, and heck, let's throw the postseason in here. He pitched 70 something innings. And even if you assume he can make a jump of 50 innings, that's 120. It feels like the Cubs are going to have to kind of move him, shift him to the bullpen just so they don't burn him out late in the year. But then also, the Cubs just feel like they can afford better. Like, this is a club that is trying to trade Cody Bellinger, which we've already talked about. The deal's not commiserate with his value, right? Like, he's overpaid for what he's giving you right now. But so many of the position player core is locked up, right? You have guys that are going to be there. And the issue with the Cubs, I feel like, is nobody, like everybody at almost every position, is top 10 or 12 at their position, but nobody's top 3 at their position, right? It's just it's a bunch of above average dudes.
Yeah.
And because of that, it's really hard to find guys that make the team meaningfully better than what you already have on the field. And when you combine that with some top prospects who are like, these are AAA guys who are ready to debut. These are not like, you know, Matt Shaw, James Triantos. These are not guys that are promising, but they're in single A. Like, these are top 100 prospects in AAA that are ready to debut. It feels like the only path you really have to get meaningfully better without a blockbuster free agent deal for a position player is in your rotation. And Shota Imanaga, Justin Steele, Jameson Taillon, Javier Assad, and Matthew Boyd just feels like that's Matthew Boyd's not the addition that moves the needle for a team that can't seem to catch the Brewers every year and needs to get better. I don't understand why a team with this much money, this devoted of a fan base, this much revenue, can't go out and add a Max Fried, a Corbin Burns, somebody bigger. And maybe they're still going to. We just talked about how a lot of guys are waiting for Soto to sign. But it feels like this is shooting too low for the Cubs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, if they would have signed Frankie Montas, I would have been more okay with that than them signing Matthew Boyd.
You at least are pretty much promised to get innings from Frankie Montas.
And per spot rec, they don't have what the incentives are for. Maybe the incentives are staying healthy and being able to play and put up innings, but he hasn't made 30 or more starts since 2019. And he's only done that twice in his career, and it was 2018 and 2019. And he hasn't pitched 100 or more innings in a season, in a regular season, since 2019. And so it's just it's just two signings that I really just don't get, man, for either team. It was a weird day in baseball.
Yeah, and both of these guys signing so early, you obviously have to think these teams see something, right? Like they believe they have something coming where they can fix these guys or get them to take a new level of performance. But it feels a little bit odd. And I think this is just more so the Cubs than the Mets. I think this is just an issue of not being aggressive enough. We fully trust the Mets are going to go out and spend a ton of money this year, right? But for the Cubs, this really feels like it's just we're just hoping to catch lightning in a bottle, and that this same group that performed practically the exact same for two straight seasons can somehow be meaningfully better for some reason next year. A team that is not content to rest on their laurels, even after winning the World Series, it's the Los Angeles Dodgers. They signed Blake Snell last week. Over the weekend, they agreed to a five-year extension with Tommy Edman. 5 years, $74 million, runs from 25 through 29, has a club option for 2030, worth $13 million. He's getting a $17 million signing bonus, and then $25 million of the total value of the extension is deferred. It'll get paid out over 10 years, starting 5 years after this ends. He was already under contract for next year. So in essence, this is a four-year extension worth $64.5 million. Two questions here. One, how happy are you that Tommy Edman finally got paid and kind of like, you know, I mean, 9.5 was nothing to sneeze at, but this dude has a guaranteed contract now and is getting paid. And should more teams pay attention to the fact that Dodgers always seem to pay these super utility guys, your Chris Taylors, your Kike Hernandezes, your Tommy Edmonds? Should more teams be understanding of that positional flexibility is worth going out and paying for?
Yeah, it's great. I have seen a lot of people saying that Tommy Edman is not deserving of the contract. I'm not one of those people, because Tommy Edman, I mean, I've got his stats pulled up right now, and just 2 years ago, he had 6.2 BWAR. And so it's when he is healthy, he is a player that is well deserving of it, because he provides, you know, above average production on offense, and he provides solid defense at multiple positions, to your point on the super utility players. He provides really good defense at all three outfield positions and shortstop. And that is a very valuable asset to have. If you are a player that can do that, then while also providing, again, above average offense, then, you know, you deserve to be paid, and teams definitely need to start paying attention to that and start trying to find guys that can do that for them, because it's been successful for the Dodgers so far. So it can work for other people.
There you go. Talking about some of like the numbers, he had a ridiculous rookie year, right? He batted over 300. You take out that half season that he was nuts his rookie year. He's a career 257 hitter, with his career high in homers being 13. But I think, to your point, the fact that he's so good defensively at premier positions and has a lot of experience there. He started 50 or more regular season games at five different positions: shortstop, center field, third base, second base, and right field. And the fact that he is just, that he's a good base runner, he grades out, I mean, even last year in a short sample size, he had 153 plate appearances. He was still plus one run value in base running, right? He was still plus two defensively in run value, despite not having actually that many innings. Then we saw in the postseason what he was able to do when he just went, I believe he was the MVP of the NLCS. He had like 11 RBI in six games, just went nuts against the Mets, batted 407. To me, I'm also glad he got paid. Like I'm with you. And he's just like, the dude's a ball player. And I think that the old school baseball people who don't like necessarily what the game has become can understand this dude's a ball player, right? He fits in well in the clubhouse. He does everything you ask him to do, and he does most of these things pretty well. He's a switch hitter. He's a good base runner. Yes, his offensive numbers aren't stellar, but he's also in a lineup where he doesn't have to carry this team offensively. You've got three former MVPs, and they might add Juan Soto this offseason. I mean, you know, you have multiple Cy Young winners in your rotation. It's a situation where this, to me, is he's the platonic ideal of a utility man right now. And I think a lot of teams should kind of learn from the Dodgers about how they've done this, right? They, again, Chris Taylor, Kike Hernandez. And now when you look at the makeup of this Dodgers roster, they have so many options that they can roll out there, right? Shortstop, Mookie Betts, Miguel Rojas, Tommy Edman. You look over at second base, those guys and Gavin Lux. Center field, you've got Edman. You've got Andy Pages has played plenty of time there. You've got so many options. I actually want to say James Altman has also played some center field. And so you can take this offseason right now. You added Blake Snell. You re-upped with Tommy Edman. I still think they're going to bring back Teoscar Hernandez. I still think he's probably a lock to come back and end up filling up one of their corner outfield spots. You could do that. And this team should still be favored to win the World Series next year as one of the best teams in baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I already have them favored to win the World Series next year, even if they don't bring back Teoscar Hernandez. It's crazy. Other teams need to start looking, because even Max Muncy, he plays third base, but if Freddie Freeman goes down, he can move over to first base.
He's played second base in his career as well.
Yeah, and it's almost everyone on their roster can play a different position. The only really glaring exception is Freddie Freeman, but you don't really want Freddie Freeman to play a different
position. Hey, as a Braves fan, I remember that 2 weeks where Freddie Freeman played third base. In like 2019 or 18, no, it was like 18 or 17, making room for Matt Adams.
I remember that also. However, I don't think anyone wants him to do that again, especially at his age. But it's everyone, literally everyone in their roster can play multiple positions. And that's a really good thing to have. It's good depth.
Yeah. Okay. So final thing, this was an interesting column from Jason Stark of The Athletic that came out on Monday. He said, Rob Manfred, Commissioner of Baseball, went on a podcast, which, stop giving people podcasts. That's a joke, obviously, because we have a podcast here. and he said that there was a little buzz at the owners' meeting of the idea of a golden at-bat. So do you remember in the WBC when Shohei Ohtani struck out Mike Trout with two outs in the ninth inning to seal a championship for Japan? They want to manufacture that moment. The concept of a golden at-bat is one at-bat in every game. A team could choose to send its best hitter to the plate, even if it wasn't that guy's turn to hit. That's the idea. Before we even get into any of the logistics, are you in or out on the idea of the golden at-bat?
So this is something that the Savannah Bananas have implemented. In their games. And when they were at Citizens Bank Park, Ryan Howard took the golden at-bat. but as far as a Major League Baseball game, without talking about any of the logistics, I am out on the golden at-bat.
Yeah, I think... when you talk about the Ohtani Trout thing, it was special because, one, they were teammates, and two, because of how rare something like that is. And if you try to make rule changes to manufacture that, like, it's not the same energy if you change things so that Luis Robert can face Sandy Alcantara in April. Like, that's not the same energy. Like, it was the stakes, it was the fact they were teammates, and it was the fact that something like that is rare. Now, the All-Star game, I am all for that. You know, give me a golden inning, right? Ninth inning. I think this is the example Jason Stark used in the article too. Give me the ninth inning. The National League is up 4-3. Guess what? Here comes Aaron Judge to the plate. Here comes Vlad Guerrero. Here comes, you know, someone else, Gunnar Henderson to the plate. They've all left the game. They didn't play after the second inning, but here come all these guys to take at bats in the ninth inning. That's fun. Yeah, let's do that. But in the regular season, let's not change the batting order, right? Let's not. It feels like it is trying to manufacture a moment to the detriment of the game. While this is something that has kind of existed in the game before, courtesy runners used to be a thing way back in the day where a dude would get hit by a pitch, somebody else would run for him, and that guy would come back out and play defense and go back into the game later. Let's not manufacture this in a regular game. I'm fine with it for an exhibition. You want to do it in spring training for fun? Sure. You know, you want to do it in the All-Star game? Okay. Let's not do it in regular season games.
Yeah, 100% agree with you. The Mike Trout and Ohtani at bat, it happened organically. And yeah, to your point, it's not going to have the same gravitas if it doesn't happen organically. And it's a lot of what Rob Manfred has done has been to bring more eyes to the game and have more people watching baseball in person and as well as on TV to increase that TV revenue money. And as most people are against a lot of the Rob Manfred changes, I'm one of the people that have liked most of his changes. If he was to do this, I'd be anti-Rob Manfred just because that's a little bit too much.
Yeah. Honestly, I love the pitch clock. I've covered games both before and after the pitch clock, and I don't want to go back without a pitch clock. Yep. The extra runner, like the ghost runner in extra innings, I wish that started in like the 11th or 12th versus the 10th inning. But I get it. It's fine. Whatever. Shift restrictions. Okay. They still shift anyway. It's not as extreme, but they still shift. But that's about it. Yeah. I don't think something like this where you're changing the batting order, that's a little too extreme for me. And I feel like, okay, we probably got to stop. Before we go real quick, the Texas Rangers have a 2-year deal with Kyle Higashioka to be to join their catching core. Terrible class for catching. We've now seen both Travis d'Arnaud and Higashioka off the table here. Does this change anything? Is this fix any of the Rangers' problems, or is this just great? They got another catcher. Jonah Heim and him are pretty good pairing, but so doesn't fix the issue of Adolis Garcia has to figure out what's going on. Marcus Semien has to bat better than .237, and guys got to stay healthy.
Yeah. No, this is a backup catcher to Jonah Heim. That's all that is. So it's doesn't move the needle in the slightest.
Yep. This has been First Pitch for Tuesday, December 30. If you're listening on audio, do us a favor, leave us a 5-star review. If you're on YouTube, subscribe to the channel, hit the notification bell. So you know, when we drop another episode, we'll be back tomorrow with more First Pitch.